Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com/contests. Test your movie knowledge and win a Nintendo Wii when you join the scavenger hunt at Spout.com/contests, going on right now. And by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting today for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, the late Sidney Pollack once said, "I like the failures as much as I like the successes. It's only the world that doesn't like the failures." Well, for this week's top five, Matty and I are going to overlook some of the actor and director's failures and focus on some of his greatest successes.
Plus, lots of great stuff on the show. Listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Austin Donahue, and the final movie in our 70s sci-fi marathon. Wait for it, Adam. The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Can't wait. We'll also review the latest from DreamWorks Animation, Kung Fu Panda. But first, a leap into the imagination of director Tarsem Singh.
How'd you hurt your arm?
My head.
Me too.
I'll tell you a story.
Close your eyes. There were five of them. The Indian. The ex-slave. An explosive expert. Charles Darwin. And the masked Bent. They had one common enemy. Governor Odious.
Is Odious bad man?
Oh, yeah.
Maddie, last week we were having a little production meeting online, having a little chat, trying to figure out what movie we were going to review. And a listener actually had just emailed in and said, "Why not review The Fall?" You said that sounds like a great idea, and then you wrote in our chat, "The Fall looks like a gorgeous feast for the eyes." And I responded, "Could be." You replied, "Just a gorgeous feast for the eyes." I can't wait to pronounce it a gorgeous feast for the eyes. For those of you maybe unfamiliar with The Fall, which is out now in limited release, the joke here has to do with the fact that the director Tarsem Singh, a.k.a. Tarsem, his previous film was The Cell in 2000, which starred Jennifer Lopez as a psychotherapist who enters the demented but lusciously set-decorated mind of a serial killer. It's also worth noting that on the DVD of The Cell, one of the extra features is a short documentary called Style as Substance, Reflections on Tarsem. So that gives you some idea what we're working with here. The trailer, Matty, which we've seen a few times for The Fall, emphasizes its dazzling visuals, the exotic locations and costumes, the epic slow-motion shots. And like The Cell, it's another case where the imagery is emanating from the mind and imagination of the characters. Here we have a young Hollywood stuntman in his early 20s in Los Angeles, Roy. He's telling a story to a young immigrant girl, Alexandria. They're both in a hospital recovering from falls. The girl has a broken arm. The man has a lot more broken, including a broken heart. So here's your chance, Matty. Is The Fall a gorgeous feast for the eyes? And even if it is, are the story and characters equally compelling?
Isn't it Reno, Nevada, that is the biggest little city in the world?
Maybe so.
I think what The Fall is really the biggest little movie in the world.
Well put.
I think in terms of sort of inventiveness and spectacle and storytelling, I would actually recommend this film over both of its bigger box office brethren, Indy and Iron Man, on the whole, because of all the things you just mentioned. It's a lot more ambitious than either of those films. Does all of it work? No. I think we're going to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the film, I had accumulated sort of my own litany of picayune-ish criticisms. You know, it's too slight. Its pacing is awkward for stretches at a time. But then this film went and did a really funny thing. It rendered nearly all of my criticisms moot when it reveals, at the end, what its true intentions really are. It's just a whimsical, bordering on silly, tribute film.
Mm-hmm.
A very specific tribute to a very specific group of people from the golden age of cinema. And in that one moment, this film basically announces that, hey, I'm not taking myself that seriously. You don't need to take me that seriously. And if there wasn't a turn towards just a tad too much violence near the end of the film, I would easily call it not only a gorgeous feast for the eyes, but the best family film of the year, sort of in the vein of The Princess Bride or The Illusionist. A really nice little big film.
Well, that's really well said. And actually, it's interesting that you bring up The Princess Bride. And also, you touched on the fact that it is a tribute film in many ways to the movies and the magic of cinema. And I actually noted that the three movies that jumped to my mind here in trying to describe The Fall to someone is it's The Princess Bride meets Sullivan Travels meets The Cell. Because, of course, you have those same visual flares that you have in The Cell. But you have a case where it's a character narrating a story to a young child, just like in The Princess Bride and the wonder of that story. But then, like Sullivan's Travels, by the end of it, it's all about the ability to be swept away into a story. We even have a similar scene where the character is actually watching a film and being carried away by it.
I do agree. You need to be swept away by the adventure a little bit too much, but at the same time, it plays with you and it pulls you back. Actually, the story he's telling you is really, really messy. And I think that's what makes it kind of fun. Hmm. He keeps calling attention to the fact that, hey, look, I'm telling this story. I'm trying to get this girl to go get me morphine. Okay?
Right.
And so that's what I liked about it. The stuff that actually happens in Oz, if you will,
sure,
is about as messy as it comes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm willing to forgive that. Where I think it fell apart for me was what's going on back in Kansas.
Okay.
The dynamic there is saved by the performance by the little girl,
yes,
for me. But that was not as intriguing as the stuff, you know, it's just sort of this visual feast that he's laying out and having a lot of fun sort of dangling this carrot in front of us.
That's really interesting because we had a really similar reaction but are actually just diverging on a couple points. And that is that what saved this movie for me was actually getting back to Kansas at the end of the film. And I don't want to take the movie too seriously either, but the big climactic scene, the emotional payoff of this entire story is what did rescue this movie for me.
Now, when you say that, are you talking about that last scene between the girl and Roy?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. And I don't want to give anything away there, and I'm going to get to it. I want to say that you're absolutely right, that for me, it was messy, and I got the fact that it's deliberately messy because this isn't like The Princess Bride where he's reading a story that's prepared. This is a case where he is making this up all along and he's drugged during part of it. So you know it's not all going to work.
Calling the Indian princesses a squaw.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah, you know it's not all going to fit together, but there's actually a point at the end of the film, near the end of the film, where Alexandria, the young girl, is crying and she says, I don't like this story. She wants it to stop because it's blurring too much into real life and it's becoming tragic. And the thing is, I agreed with her when she said that. I didn't like the story either, almost from the moment that Roy started telling it. I found the characters and the narrative he was creating to be, honestly, incredibly dull and uninteresting. I didn't
You're
find
right.
any of those characters
I think we're both agreeing that
compelling.
That's the point.
Maybe it is the point, but I still wish that I was more drawn into that world because the visuals alone, for me, actually weren't enough to carry me through it. Again, I understand that that's what he's going for. It's all a ruse to get Alexandria to bring him some morphine. He's not this great storyteller, but it just never pulled me in. And actually, all that swooping, dazzling cinematography, in the end, then, had little effect on me. I actually didn't really see how the style fit the substance of the story other than just being imaginative and kind of the opposite of real life, the Oz to Kansas. I know that that's what he's going for again, but it really did just kind of seem indulgent to me and Tarsem showing off. It didn't add up to much. But what did save it is that last 20 minutes or so of the film. Without any real manipulation or sentimentality, and very simply, Tarsem is actually able to get at the emotional depths of this relationship between this stuntman and the young girl. I actually think, Maddie, I have to confess, it's the first time this year so far where it got a little dusty for me in the theater.
Wow.
The finale of this story that he's telling, which coincides, of course, with the finale of our story, it really hit me, and I think a huge part
really?
Of it, yeah, it really did. It really
it had, the
had an impact
opposite
on me.
Effect on me.
I
really
loved it.
Didn't.
And
it really didn't. Wow.
What worked so much about it was the 9-year-old girl, then maybe 7 or 8 when she filmed this. She's playing a 6-year-old, I believe, here in the story. The Romanian actress, Cătinca Untaru, and I hope I'm saying that right, or Untaru. She is so amazing, and she actually made me think about how much I liked Abigail Breslin and Little Miss Sunshine and some of these other young actresses.
The fact of the matter, she blows Abigail Breslin and Anna Paquin
Dakota Fanning.
Out of the water.
Right.
Out of the water. She
really
is
does.
Amazing in this film.
And you don't really notice that until you see a performance like this that you then reflect on some of those other child performances and you realize that they're actually very calculated. You know, they've
yes.
already developed into young actors. They have a bag of tricks and they know how to hit all
Cătinca
the right
here
notes.
Cătinca here is not playing pretend at
no.
all. She is fighting. Basically, the director said, what you want to do is you want to hear this story. You want
right.
to hear this story. And my God, it must have just been improvised scenes because
mm-hmm.
it is so natural and we can see her instincts fighting. I need to hear
exactly.
this story. That's what saved it for me when we were back in that sort of reality land. What I actually enjoyed about the film, you're right, it doesn't sweep you in. And that's kind of, I went along with that. I'm thinking, wow, this works on a sort of meta level. When we tell a story, kind of an uninteresting
it's
story.
It's going to be flawed
a really
and
sort of
uneven.
Patchwork. Exactly. I thought it was sort of a commentary on storytelling and its essence right there. And I think that's where I enjoyed it. But for me, I didn't get that climactic build because I didn't have a sense of who Governor Odious was in the real world. I didn't have a sense of who Roy's love interest was and the effect that she had on him. There are just a couple shots of her. There's some pictures of her as well by the bedstand. I didn't really get a sense
of the actress that broke his heart, apparently.
Right. I didn't get the impact that she had on him. And maybe what you're saying is I should have gotten that impact through the story.
Maybe so.
But
no,
I didn't.
I agree that's messy. And again, the story within the story is messy. But then when you break it down to its essential, the elemental level, it comes down to the story between Roy and Alexandria. And that hit me hard at the end. I have to give Tarsem a lot of credit.
In a land of tradition and honor, one kung fu master,
let's get started,
has trained five of the greatest warriors the world has ever known. But this master's biggest challenge has just arrived.
I'm coming!
Stairs.
Yeah!
Jack Black.
Go ahead, Panda. Show us what you can do.
Are they going to watch, or should I just wait until I get back to work or something?
Just hit it.
Adam, I'm absolutely delighted that we're reviewing these two films together because it allows me to say, wow, Kung Fu Panda is a gorgeous feast for the eyes.
Well played.
I am a sucker for animation, and I just have to say, I don't really have an understanding of, you know, how the work that goes into making these films. My general understanding is that there are teams of animators that are assigned certain characters and certain elements.
Or certain big scenes.
Yeah. Whoever was assigned to the turtle in this film, the old sort of sensei, the master, right, should win an Academy Award. Because that character, just the way he moved his jaw, it was just perfect. It blew me away.
Yeah, the details here are really great. And we did have a lot of listeners who wrote in. We had this poll question, what movie should we review? We just didn't really feel like we'd get much of a discussion out of Kung Fu Panda. And that's why we're only giving it a few minutes. But I did really like this movie, as it sounds like you did too. And I'm with you because those details are so wonderful. And I saw this little making of thing on HBO, and they mentioned how they weren't going to do this send-up. It wasn't going to be like the Shrek movies full of these clever little pop culture references.
Right, right.
And that has been pretty played out by now, and it works here great without them. The humor all comes from the story.
It harkens back to that simple storytelling of Snow White and Cinderella. Is it quite on that level? No. But still, I mean, the execution is so sound here. And again, you have so much time going into making these movies. It's really refreshing to see, hey, They're using what works. They're actually making decisions and saying, hey, we don't need that clever throwaway joke that doesn't quite work. Let's make it a really great story-based plot. It was a really lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, it was. And there's a great movie geek parallel here that I had a lot of fun with. And I'll just briefly tell this story. The other night I was talking to my wife about Rio Bravo because we were talking about it in our class. And I was saying how I want to go on vacation to old Tucson, that old movie set where they shoot all these Westerns, you know, so I can just kind of geek out and be like, here's the scene where Dean Martin walks into the bar
Your
and
poor wife.
Regains his dignity. Exactly.
Wife.
And Sarah's like, and what would I do?
Yeah.
What would I do there? Why do I want to go to old Tucson? Well, the great thing about this movie is that Jack Black's character, the Kung Fu Panda Po, he's kind of that character where he's just going crazy about the fact that he loves Kung Fu and he gets to see all these people that he reveres and all these moves that he has always wanted to be able to pull off. And he's getting to see all these things he's only dreamed about, and he's getting his chance to live that out and getting to have his dream turn into a reality. That's a lot of fun to watch and just easy to relate to. And I also think that the movie is, thinking about the last DreamWorks film, B-Movie, this is a huge improvement B-Movie, which I think was really a mess. I mean, it looks great. I'm not ripping on the animation in any way, but just in terms of a story, it was a disaster, I think. And, you know, here, DreamWorks, they aren't being as audacious, as ambitious as maybe Brad Bird with a movie like Ratatouille. The story here is really predictable, really standard kind of Cinderella stuff in terms of where the characters are going. And you aren't going to walk out of the theater thinking about its larger themes like maybe you do with a movie such as Ratatouille. But you know what? Po here is a hell of a lot more interesting and fun to watch on screen than Linguini in Ratatouille. And I had a blast with it.
I agree. Well, I think it just goes to show you, yeah, it can be the same story, but if you tell it really well, you're going to have a really rapt audience. I do have one little cultural criticism that I have to make, and I would be remiss if I didn't make it, but I was struck by this. Why did the Chinese have to be rabbits?
I'm not sure.
Why did they have to be? I mean, I get the idea that they're all the characters here are basically animals from the Chinese zodiac. But why did the Chinese have to be rabbits who are buck-toothed and are known for having lots of children? That is one criticism that really stuck in my craw from the beginning, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say anything. So you can start your hate mail now, but I have to admit that it did bug me. That's one thing I thought that was overlooked that didn't have to be.
I actually didn't even remember the rabbits in the film, so that was completely lost on me. I do want to praise the film as well for the kung fu scenes, the detail in those scenes, the scope of them. They're truly cinematic. They don't feel small like a lot of animated films do.
Yeah, and
at
every
all.
Fight is recognizable, too. We talked about that in Speed Racer, where the action happens so fast in the CGI world, we don't know what's going on. Here, everything is so clear and so distinct.
Yep, I was going to make that same point. We've been talking about action scenes a lot this summer, naturally, in Speed Racer, whether they worked or not in Indiana Jones 4. It's going to come up here in the next segment and listener feedback. But here, you're right, you see everything play out in a really satisfying way. And there's that one great fight scene on the bridge where it's undulating, it's been cut, and they're having this battle. And one character, I can't remember which one it is hanging on and kind of flying through the air. And I have to admit, I actually got that little feeling in my stomach, like when you're on an amusement park ride, in that scene, just because of the way it's shot and the way it's animated. It had that effect on me sitting in the theater. And I am glad that enough listeners wrote in compelling us to check out Kung Fu Panda. It's definitely worth your time.
Well, I don't know what's more interesting, watching the movie itself or watching you watch a kid's movie surrounded by tons of talkative children and parents. Adam needs complete silence.
I need complete silence.
You need to bow down before that movie.
I had to deal with the two people in front of me who were texting, and then even worse, once they stopped, I had to deal with the critic, yes, you the critic, whoever it was in the front row, turning his little pen light on every 2 seconds. I swear, I think he was actually writing his review as the movie was going on. I hope it's a masterpiece. I hope it wins him a Pulitzer, because he was constantly shining that light and annoying the hell out of me. I'm sorry, I just can't stand it.
Next time, I'm going to sneak in a little camera and YouTube you, because more people should be witness to this.
Yeah. Well, Kung Fu Panda is out now in theaters everywhere. I hope you have a better movie-going experience than I do. The Fall is also out now in limited release, of course. And if you see either movie and agree or disagree with our takes, email feedback at filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail. You can do that by calling 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. I wasn't invested at all, and I didn't believe any of it for a single second. And you should know that the fact that you didn't give it the scathing review it deserved broke my heart. Your thoughts on Indiana Jones 4 are up next in listener feedback. Stay with us.
I'm not ready for the weekend. I'm not ready for the day. Procrastination has me reeling. To soldier on beneath the weight. Beneath the weight.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like Film Spotting. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting for your free audiobook.
Hey, Adam and Matt, it's Eve from Brooklyn, New York. And if you saw the Sex and the City movie, you know that Brooklyn is the new Manhattan and that only someone from Brooklyn could have written that. I really enjoyed the movie, having been a pretty invested, although not obsessed, watcher of the HBO series. I found the movie incredibly satisfying and was really moved by performances, particularly of Sarah Jessica Parker, Cynthia Nixon, and Kristen Davis, who I think often gets the shaft for being the charming, ever upbeat and positive Charlotte York Goldenblatt.
Hi, this is Kyle from Duluth, Minnesota, and I just listened to the very entertaining debates about Sex and the City, and I had to just say I didn't get this movie at all. And you know, I saw Maid of Honor, Patrick Dempsey. I saw 27 Dresses, you know, a quote-unquote chick flick. And I found myself smiling and laughing at that movie. And during Sex and the City, there was times when the entire movie theater was laughing hysterically, and I was confused. Do girls really sit around, drink Cosmopolitans, and gossip the entire time? That's all it was for two and a half hours. I didn't get it. And, you know, I thank you guys for a great heated debate.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. A split take there on Sex in the City. Eve in Brooklyn, Kyle in Duluth, maybe not surprisingly, Eve in Brooklyn clearly liked the movie. Kyle did not get Sex in the City. Can't say I totally blame him, but we will get into more of your thoughts on Sex in the City on next week's show during listener feedback. We're really going to devote this segment to Indiana Jones 4. And Maddie, this was the largest batch of feedback we've ever received for a single film. So a lot of people are seeing it, and a lot of people had thoughts. We'll get to those in a minute. First, I wanted to briefly say thanks to Antonio, one of our listeners from Lisbon, Portugal. He was in Chicago last week, and, you know, it's right there in all the Chicago travel guides, you know, see Wrigley Field, mm-hmm. Sears Tower, all those things, meet up with local film critic Adam Kempinar, I guess. Yeah. He wanted to meet up with me. I have to say, we ended up seeing The Fall, actually, together and bought me lunch afterwards. Antonio was very nice, so just want to say thanks again to Antonio. I love meeting up with our listeners, especially ones from places as exotic as lovely Lisbon, Portugal. So again, thanks for that. Our poll question this week on the show, we're going to save that for our top five because it relates to our top five topic, and that is the late, great Sidney Pollack. Last week's poll question, though, Maddie, was about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. We wanted to get sort of the summary take on the film. We asked our listeners, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull lived up to the hype, was okay, not the worst in the franchise, was a big disappointment, or haven't seen it yet. What did the listeners say, Maddie?
Number one, was okay, not the worst in the franchise, coming in at 36%. Haven't seen it yet, 29%. Was a big disappointment, 28%. Lived up to the hype, only 7%. Is that you? Is that you down there?
No, it wasn't, actually. No, I did not say that. If you'll recall from last week's show, which I know you don't actually listen to me as I talk, I went with was okay, not the worst in the franchise. See, the listeners are on my side after all, Maddie.
Well, wasn't that me too?
No, you were was a big disappointment, remember?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that movie.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, that was a huge disappointment.
Well, 28% of our listeners did agree with you. It was pretty close there. So let's go ahead and get into some of our listeners' thoughts on Indiana Jones 4, what works and what didn't work, apparently. Let's start with a few voicemails.
Hi, Film Spotting. This is John Anderson from Minot, North Dakota. I'm calling in to leave a voicemail regarding Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. This film was so disappointing. I can only compare it to sequels like Moonraker, for instance, and I think that's kind of fitting considering the sci-fi element, just in how badly it screws up the entire idea of this franchise.
Hey, Film Spotting guys. This is Jason Eakin from Kansas City. Great show this week. Lots to talk about. First off, you guys are totally right about Indiana Jones. Except I did think that that action sequence in the jungle with the Jeeps was really awesome. That was kind of Spielberg at his best.
Hi, Adam and Maddie. This is Falarin from Memphis, Tennessee, originally Nigerian. I actually walked out of this movie because it was boring. And I was like, wow, did Spielberg actually make this? Is he getting old? I mean, what's going on? I didn't finish the movie. I walked out about 30 minutes into the end after the whole jungle sequence.
Hey guys, it's Todd in Shrewsbury. I need people to stop complaining about Indiana Jones ruining their childhood. Why don't you just not watch the new one then? I mean, I don't see how it could possibly ruin your childhood. I can understand you not enjoying the movie. I myself thought it was okay. It was enjoyable. Incredibly entertaining. It didn't ruin my childhood at all, and I grew up watching Indiana Jones all the time.
Well, it's interesting there that you heard Todd mention how he didn't understand these listeners, Maddie, talking about how this film ruined their childhoods. And actually, Miguel from Portugal wrote in with a nice little note and said that he had a message to all the people overreacting to how Indiana Jones 4 destroyed their childhood. Wasn't it already in pieces since Star Wars Episode 1 came out? Which is a good question.
But did you buy into the Star Wars machine? I mean, before that thing came out, I knew there's no way that Lucas was going to make that film great.
You know, I really liked that you said that because that's exactly how I went into this film, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, with way lowered expectations because, no, I didn't expect Lucas to turn out a gem with The Phantom Menace, and I didn't expect Lucas and Spielberg to come up with anything great here either.
Well, the fact of the matter is the first trilogy, the first three in the Indiana Jones trilogy, are not CGI heavy. Well, Lucas, of course, kills Star Wars with that, you know, CGI that he employs, the Jar Jar effect.
Yeah.
Here, it's almost killed again by CGI.
I agree.
Those ants, those gophers, they're not needed.
I'm with you, but one listener who did have some fun with this film, Maddie, why don't you go ahead and kick it off?
Yes, Mr. Greg from Anamosa, Iowa. Am I saying that right?
You are, Maddie. Well done.
On episode 211, Maddie, you were grilling Adam on the purpose of the crystal skull. You ask, what are they, the Russians, supposed to do with that crystal skull? I feel compelled to ask you, what are the Nazis supposed to do with the striped rocks from Temple of Doom? What were the children mining for? Why were they performing bizarre rituals? I can't remember. I'm sure you won't either. The fact is, I still enjoyed Temple of Doom for the same reasons I enjoyed Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which are whips, bugs, guns, snakes, knives, jungles, fedoras, and laughs. In other words, fun.
Yeah.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I don't think there are any Nazis actually in Temple of Doom. Mola Ram is the head of the cult that worships Kali. He is enslaving the children to dig for the remaining stones.
You looked this up, didn't you?
So that he might take over the world.
Yeah, well done.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, you looked it up. But
right.
That's okay.
I remember that. Mola Ram. Mola Ram.
Moving on, though, Maddie, I think that Greg does make an interesting point there, which is that when you get down to it, what were the Nazis going to do with the Ark, for example, in Raiders of the Lost Ark? They're going to use it to somehow try to dominate the world. I think that's the same point here. We'll actually hear from a listener who I think makes that point pretty well here in a moment. Let's get to Jay in L.A., who says, I watched National Treasure on vacation less than 24 hours before seeing Indy 4. And while, yes, the Indy crew are more fun to spend time with and the visuals are not comparable, there are a ton of parallels, and I gotta say, I like a treasure hidden in Mount Rushmore with cool American history more than some alien skull that we have no clue what it does and why I should want it. The stakes in Indy sucked. There was no chase. The bad guys and good guys were on a parallel path to the entire movie, completely killed any potential tension. Honestly, the only thing that saved Indy was Indy. If this plot and story execution had been with any other film, we all would have hated it. Bottom line is, we love spending time with Indy, and the film delivered it. But I want that to be a side dish as part of a meal, not the only thing edible.
Yeah, it speaks to the
larger... Really well said.
Yeah, it speaks to this larger point that the mythology surrounding the crystal skull is never really established.
Mm-hmm.
We never get to go along with Indy as he deciphers all these clues and puts, you know, all the puzzles together. Fedoras and jungles are fine, but sans plot, it's lazy, lazy filmmaking.
Well, I actually do agree with you there, but I think Jay really nails it that for me, I pointed out some of the things that didn't work about this film, and they are many. But in the end, I think it was Indy being Indy that worked for me, that made me able to get through the CGI ants and have some fun with this film. Let's go to this one from Blake in New York.
On the subject of Indy 4, I want to say this. I loved it. I personally refused to see Iron Man simply because I wanted to kick off my summer blockbuster fest with a great film. And gentlemen, I have never made a better decision in my entire life. I really was on the edge of my seat for Indy, and I think that there was the perfect amount of nods to the past, and it never pulled me out of the story. I also love the fact that instead of another tired theology-based action-adventure, it was brought into a new dimension. As the car chase through the forest pulled back and we see off the edge of the cliff, I leaned over to my brother, who is a fellow Indyite, and I simply said, this movie just somehow got better, and I will stand behind it as much as I possibly can. Keep up the great work, guys.
It is true, we suggested this last week on the show, that when you break down the percentage of positive Indiana Jones 4 emails to negative, the negative ones are much higher. But
yeah,
there were a few people like Blake that did have a lot of fun with this movie, and Jeff in Tulsa, Oklahoma, actually wants to come to the defense of the film as well. He says, I'm fine with people not liking Crystal Skull. Despite my continuing admiration, I saw it again this weekend at a drive-in with an Iron Man double feature. Obviously, they heard Maddie's suggestion. I can appreciate why some people may not like it. Still, when I hear comments like the second caller you played last week, I really have to shake my head. To call Spielberg an incompetent action director displays true, well, incompetence. Everything about this film is beautifully crafted, and the action set pieces are particularly striking in comparison to many modern-day blockbusters. Bay's Transformers finale, now there's incompetence. From the opening warehouse sequence to the chase through the university to the jungle chase, it's all impressive and fun. I love the jungle chase in particular with the added comedic layer of the hot potato with the crystal skull between three vehicles. Again, dislike the film if you must. Screenplay, performances, how it doesn't live up to the past indie films, etc. But Steven Spielberg is not an incompetent director.
isn't Film Spotting on record as saying Spielberg is not an incompetent action director?
He's also not an infallible director, though. He clearly does have some clunky scenes throughout many of his films, and they are on display here as well. But I'm with Jeff. I don't think you can call him on the whole. You can't dismiss him as incompetent.
All right. Well, Christine Gentry from Boston, Massachusetts writes in, I couldn't believe my ears, Adam, when you said things like you had a lot of fun with it and that the story is really Raiders of the Lost Ark with communists in place of Nazis. Seriously? This movie was the emotional equivalent of a root canal. This screenplay could have been written by a third grader, and bringing in aliens was a huge mistake. There were multiple times when I turned to the person next to me and accurately predicted the next line in the gag reflex-inducing dialogue. I wasn't invested at all, and I didn't believe any of it for a single second. You're wrong, Maddie. It most certainly did destroy a glorious franchise. And Adam, I hope you enjoy the new car that Spielberg must have bought for you in order to buy the positive parts of your review.
Ouch.
I want to go on record as thanking you for the few negative things you did say.
Thank you.
If you need me, I'll be deconstructing the pedestal on which I once held your podcast.
Ouch.
The
again.
Line of the year. I love that.
Yeah, maybe so. Christine there from Boston. You know what, though? Chris White, we're going to close with this great email. I know we both really enjoyed getting Chris from Greenville, South Carolina, and he's actually got my back. He's going to defend me here to Christine, at least in terms of her comment about having fun with the plot and it being like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Chris writes, I remember being 14 years old, seeing Temple of Doom, rocking back and forth in my seat with unbridled enthusiasm and excitement. I had no idea that this movie would eventually be decried as the Temple of Crap. As well, I remember watching Last Crusade. I was a way too smart for his own good crimes and misdemeanors obsessed college freshman, arms crossed and brow furrowed during the overlit and badly acted yet obligatory exposition scene with Indy and Donovan. I started to reject this unholy grail tale outright. Then, 5 or 10 minutes later in Venice, I suddenly realized that I was sitting directly behind my 14-year-old self, a kid rocking back and forth in his seat with unbridled enthusiasm and excitement. And I remember relaxing at that moment, giving over to this last crusade, being able to, in spite of myself, enjoy the ride. And now, I'm a 38-year-old dad sitting in a midnight screening of Crystal Skull on opening day with my 10-year-old son, Whitaker, who is dressed head to toe as Dr. Jones. And he's rocking back and forth in his seat with unbridled enthusiasm and excitement as ants swarm and the heroes survive another implausible waterfall drop.
Whitaker and I listened to your review together last night, and I tell you, Maddie, he's pretty pissed. He thinks you're way off base. Thinks that Indy 4 is the best one yet and can't wait for another. He kept saying, Maddie is missing the point.
Yes.
Witt defended the film's plot perfectly, having only seen it once. And as he did, he and I both realized that is the same plot of Raiders and Doom and Crusade. Archaeologist must recover artifact and respectfully return it.
That's it.
The point is that we're willing. We get to have a great time watching our hero accomplish this. We, me and Witt, think you both just need to chill. Take a look around the theater, boys. The rest of us are rocking back and forth in our seats with unbridled enthusiasm and excitement. That's the secret Misters Lucas, Spielberg, and Ford so brilliantly exploit to their advantage once again in Indy 4. But hey, don't worry, fellas. Whitaker and I are still listening to our favorite podcast, though with arms crossed, awaiting your Dark Knight review. Great, great email.
It was a great email. And Maddie, I think, don't you have a challenge you want to throw out there maybe to Chris?
I do have a challenge because Whitaker actually and I are a lot alike because Adam knows this, much to his embarrassment. I will often dress up as the lead character of the movie we're reviewing that night. It really
Last
gets,
week,
yeah,
Carrie Bradshaw.
Exactly.
And you were luscious.
I was. Wasn't
you
look
great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Dad, if you can provide me some sort of ocular proof that Whitaker was indeed dressed head to toe as Dr. Jones, I will send you both a Film Spotting t-shirt.
Wow. Can't beat that deal. Thanks again for the email, Chris, and to everyone who wrote in. Again, a huge batch of feedback, and most of it was negative, but it was great to hear from some people like Chris who did have a lot of fun with this movie. If you have any feedback for us, send us your thoughts, feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll dive into your Sex and the City reactions, as I mentioned, next week on the show, plus your top 5 best-dressed characters feedback.
Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater and... calling all the young dudes. This is Ground Control. We're off to Suffragette City with David Bowie and the Man Who Fell to Earth. Stay with us.
Chasing paper, a sea of numbers in the park. Celebration turns to thunder in this dark home. I buried my
you saying that nobody in New York will work with me?
Oh, no, that's too limited. Nobody in Hollywood wants to work with you either. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They want a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic! A tomato can't move!
That's what I said! So if he can't move, how's he gonna sit down, George? I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato! Nobody does vegetables like me! I did an evening of vegetables off Broadway! I did the best tomato, the best cucumber! I did an endive salad that knocked the critics on their ass!
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Matty Robinson and Adam Kempinar. Time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show wherein Adam and I brutally massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, as many of you pointed out, our little tribute to Sidney Pollack. I think the Pollack family would be really touched, actually, by the outpouring of respect shown the man through the entries that we received this week. He died of cancer on May 26th at the age of 73.
Yes, he did. And apparently the scene we picked was the scene that made all the rounds in every media tribute to him, especially Fresh Air. A lot of Terry Gross fans out there in Film Spotting land because they all heard it. And this actually now is the second most entered Massacre Theater ever, right behind the Iron Giant. So a lot of Tootsie fans out there as well, I think.
Deservingly so.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Adam, why don't you reach into that Film Spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
And the winner is Trung Mai from Morgan City, Louisiana. Where's Morgan City, Maddie?
All right.
How close
I don't know.
To New
All right,
Orleans?
This is a huge guess. I'm going to say it's 2 hours away, but it's closer to Lafayette.
Or Baton Rouge.
Is that a town in Louisiana?
I don't know. Congratulations to Trung, who has been listening to the show and entering Massacre Theater for a long time. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
It's a scene, man. Memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's got to be Marlon Brando, right? To do this job, you got to be a great actor. You got to be naturalistic. You got to be naturalistic as hell.
Maddie, we move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and we're going to say by way of a hint that it does not directly, as far as we know, tie in with any topic on this week's show. However, there is a reason we are doing this scene. Is
yes.
that a good way to put it?
Yeah. Well, you know, week after week, we've had some really easy ones. I'm mm-hmm. glad we're challenging them, our audience here.
Okay. Well, every time we say that, they come out en masse and tell us how stupid we are and how obvious this scene is. I actually think that's going to happen again this week. You're going to direct me, so go ahead and give me the action.
And action.
There might be a legal precedent. Of course. Land snatching. Let's see. Snatch. Snatch, snatch. Ah, Haley versus United States. Haley 7, United States nothing. You see, it can be done. It can be done. Unfortunately, there is one thing that stands between me and that property. The rightful owners. There must be some way of scaring them off, driving them out, getting rid of every human being alive. It's down the hall and to the left.
No, sir.
What?
I got it.
You do what? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Creek.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
And scene. Nicely done, Mr. Kempinar.
I was trying to redeem my bad Dustin Hoffman last week.
A nice
week.
Little tribute, if you will.
Yes, it was. Another little hint there. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback at filmspotting.net by Wednesday, June 11th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
That's basic patterns. Do you know what that means?
Yes, I think so.
Do you really? I wonder. It means, Mr. Newton, that you can take RCA, Eastman Kodak, and DuPont for starters.
In, say, 3 years, what would this be worth to me?
I'm a lawyer, not an accountant, Mr. Newton. But I'd say it must be something in the area of $300 million.
Not more.
Adam, you and I both know that one pill makes you larger, one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother give you probably allow you to conceive of the fantastic premise that is The Man Who Fell to Earth. 1976 film based on the 1963 science fiction novel of the same name. An alien in the form of David Bowie lands on Earth with a mission of transporting some of the Earth's water back to his own imperiled planet. Now, Adam, this film is a bit of a departure from our marathon to some extent. I actually found this one in the cult section of my neighborhood DVD store. And in Man Who Fell to Earth, we're not dealing with the end of humankind as we did in Omega Man or Silent Running. And we're also not dealing with futuristic sort of literal Potemkin villages as we did in Logan's Run and Soylent Green. This movie is set in the present day for all intents and purposes, and very akin to sort of the stranger in a strange land genre of movies. So my question to you is, A, does it fit our marathon? And are the lessons learned here in this film as penetrating and as intriguing to you as the larger lessons imparted by the earlier films?
Well, both good questions. And you're absolutely right. I noted the same thing, that with regard to how it fits into this marathon, it is a little bit of an odd case because it is the only second time, actually, that a movie was in the present day. The Andromeda Strain was the only
film
that took place in the present day. This isn't the future. There isn't a utopia or a dystopia to contend with. But like all the films in this marathon, there is a little bit of a present-day message there. And clearly, Nicholas Roeg, the director, is a lot less interested in the environment and more concerned with cultural decay and materialism. And certainly, he likes to take some shots at television and how we see that sort of rotting the main character's brain as well as everyone else that surrounds him. As to the question of how penetrating it is, I didn't find it as penetrating, as interesting. I didn't find the concepts as intriguing as some of the other films in the marathon. I think this is a case where the pleasures of this movie are the surreal imagery and the jumping around in time with the characters aging suddenly, the discontinuity editing. It's almost like a David Lynch film, to put it in a more modern context, some of his more experimental stuff, where it doesn't really add up rationally or narratively, but emotionally and viscerally, it all kind of works. It gives you enough of a story to hang on to, but what you remember are the images, the shots of the drought back on his home planet with his family. Those things are what stay with you. The first time he has sex with Mary Lou, that's something I don't think I'll ever be able to scrape off my retinas, the back of them anyway. So I think those are the pleasures of this film, and I did have fun with it.
I loved it.
Really?
I really, really loved it. I was so swept up in it. And you're right. There are just so many elements going on. But I'm going to give the director a lot of credit. He really does keep it linear for the most part. He's cutting in and out, but it does move forward. You are able to catch up with what's going
on. There's a story there moving forward.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Now, it did dangle on the precipice just a little bit. The last 20 minutes, that one scene between Mary Lou and David Bowie, we're kind of in Roger Corman, John Waters land there.
Yeah,
a little bit. That's when it almost lost me, but then it brought me back. And what it was the performances by Rip Torn and Buck Henry.
He's great.
Who is fantastic as his lawyer. And again, I get back to this plot. I love it. I wish I could have written this. I love how he's got to make enough money to transport water back to his planet. So how is he going to do that? He's going to sell and patent his own technology
right.
from his planet, and he's going to take over the world with world industry, basically. He's going to corner the market and make this, you know, conglomerate company.
Right.
And that's fantastic. And what I also love about it is that he achieves that, and we don't spend a lot of time in that world. Basically, the director says, all right, this is how he's going to do that.
Just go with it.
He's
a millionaire.
We're going to move on, and then we get to move into the addictions. And you're right. It's an allegory for society. Basically, he's crippling himself by watching television, by getting addicted to alcohol. I loved it.
Yeah. No, I did like it as well, and I have to give it some credit for making use of one of my favorite poems of all time, and actually one of my favorite paintings, about suffering. They were never wrong. The old masters, how well they understood its human position, how it takes place. That's from W.H. Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts. I love that poem, and it's responding to Peter Bruegel's painting, The Fall of Icarus. And this movie actually sort of gets that right, where it's a case where, just like Icarus falling from the sky and suffering and dying, and everyone around him is oblivious to it. Life is just sort of going on with everyone watching their TV sets. That's what
right.
we do get here. He appropriates those cultural images in that poem very well, I think. And this is Nicholas Roeg, Maddie, who you may remember a few weeks ago, or actually a couple months ago, we did our top five sex scenes, our top five love scenes. Don't Look Now was my number one and our guest critic's number one. Don't Look Now is just 3 years before that. We actually get the same kind of discontinuous sex scene here in this film in terms of the great one with Rip Torn, where it just goes from scene to scene where he's having sex with one young co-ed, and then we see it's another one and another one. It jumps around in time a lot. And actually, I couldn't help but think as well, of course, of the movie Velvet Goldmine. Clearly Todd Haynes with that film, what's so bugged out about that movie is the style of it. He's clearly paying homage to this David Bowie film in terms of the way things just jump around and the surreal imagery. As I mentioned, he's clearly paying homage to Rogue there. And actually, if I recall Velvet Goldmine, doesn't the Brian Slade character actually wall himself off from the world in his mansion in the same way that happens to Bowie here, where he gets imprisoned in this apartment that's actually in a warehouse?
Yeah.
I think that happens in Velvet Goldmine as well. So you actually really do clearly see what Haynes was going for there. Made me appreciate Velvet Goldmine more, and I'm with you about Buck Henry and Candy Clark as Mary Lou. I loved her.
I just didn't like her when she came back. She comes back as an older version of herself, and her makeup is really off because everybody else ages really well in this film. Even Bernie Casey, who's playing sort of the FBI guy. A lot of people remember Bernie Casey, of course, from Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah.
Yeah, as Ewing from Lambda, Lambda, Lambda. But Bowie here is good, too, because he can be wooden.
Oh, he's
so
good.
He can be as wooden as possible, and it works because he's an alien. And I just love the sort of the reserve calm in his voice. He is being tortured just as long as society is torturing itself, only in a different way, because he is doomed to outlive everybody. And of course, he's not able throughout the better part of the film to get back to his planet.
Mm-hmm.
And what's also interesting is that Bowie had introduced Ziggy Stardust earlier in the 70s. And now Ziggy Stardust is, I mean, he's a wild rock child. He was a charismatic guy who ends up dead pretty much in part through his own indulgences. By contrast, this character, I mean, he could be Ziggy's priest, so staid, so reserved, but ultimately destroyed by the same things. I really got into this movie. It gripped me. It had me from frame number one.
Okay, I saw it as more of a curio, I think, just in that kind of cult classic. It didn't grab me maybe the way Soylent Green even actually grabbed me, but I did enjoy watching it without a doubt. And just to give you an idea of the insanity of this movie, maybe the best way for me to sum it up is actually imagine the big press scene, if you haven't seen The Man Who Fell to Earth, where he's trying to take off, he wants to launch his spaceship up into the sky, and there's all this press surrounding and all these government officials, and Jim Lovell, the astronaut, the one who all know from Apollo 13, the real Jim Lovell actually makes an appearance. Like, why would Nicholas Rogue want to cast a real astronaut in this scene? I don't know, but I loved it.
It's the 70s, man.
Yeah.
It's the 70s. Get on board.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well, we will take a week off from our marathons next week. That does close out the movie portion of our 70s sci-fi marathon. I think we both had a lot of fun with it. We're going to come back 2 weeks from now and have our 70s sci-fi awards. And Chris Vanderkay from the Studio Upstairs podcast had a great idea when this marathon started, saying we should call our awards the Damn Dirty Apes, which really is perfect in terms of sci-fi and Heston, who we saw twice. But Ben Jackson also had a good one on our message boards, The Carousels, which movie should be renewed, of course, referencing Logan's Run. I like both of them, but I'm leaning towards Damn Dirty Apes right now.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, we will do our Damn Dirty Ape Awards in a couple weeks here on Film Spotting.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we return, Film Spotting pretends The Interpreter and Random Hearts never happened. Our top five Sidney Pollack movies are up next. Stay with us. Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
Coming out this Tuesday on DVD, Maddie, Funny Games, a movie from earlier this year, Michael Haneke's film, the remake of his own film that we somehow ended up enjoying very much.
Loved it.
We recommend seeing it if you have not. Also out, Jumper, a movie from Doug Liman that I almost pushed us to review.
Your boy, Doug Liman.
I know. And then we didn't end up seeing it and heard brutal things about it. That's out now with an audio commentary from Doug Liman. The Other Boleyn Girl, another semi-disaster from this year that sounded interesting in premise, but maybe not so much in execution. And also The Grand Maddie, this is a film that was actually a subject of Maddie's Movie Minute, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and it was pretty much a disaster. Bad improv is really bad to watch.
I think your Maddie's Movie Minute segment was more entertaining than the film itself.
Well, thank you, Mr.
When are we going to get another Maddie's Movie Minute?
Well, now that we're done with the University of Chicago class, I've got a little bit of free time. I'm going to get back out on that dating scene and start checking out some more of these popcorn flicks.
You just don't go to movies by yourself like I do.
I can't.
It's so depressing.
I can't do that.
Yeah. Also out, speaking of our University of Chicago class, we just argued about this a little bit last week. High Noon, a two-disc Ultimate Collector's Edition. It's supposed to be a better transfer, better print from the Collector's Edition that came out a few years ago, and it does have a few more DVD features, including a 50-minute documentary on the making of the film. You can find all the DVDs we mentioned in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just visit the movie store link at filmspotting.net. We also have this week an exciting new contest to announce in conjunction with our great partners over at Spout.com. For the past couple of months, of course, we've been recasting classic movies like The Princess Bride, like Ghostbusters, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Had a lot of fun with that. But this week, it's getting personal, perhaps even traumatic. Spout and Film Spotting want to read, in 200 words or less, about your most scarring movie experience. Maybe it was watching 8mm, which is a really terrible Joel Schumacher film, or maybe it was watching Howard the Duck, a box office bomb that Maddie thinks deserves more love. Either way, we want to hear about it.
Go to filmgaming.spout.com, and in less than 200 words, share the movie experience that scarred you for life using the powers of pure subjectivity. Again, we will pick the person with the most scarring movie experience to win some swanky Spout swag.
And Maddie and I may even participate, try to chime in with our most traumatic movie-going experience. Again, go to filmgaming.spout.com and expunge some of those traumatic memories. You can also go to filmspotting.net. You'll see the image there in the right rail at the top of the page to go to filmgaming.spout.com.
All right, time now for donations. We want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. Thank you to Jonathan in beautiful Boulder, Colorado, Benjamin in Eagle, Idaho, and Hannah Isaacson in Solna, Sweden, Gustav III's old hunting grounds. And I'm actually really glad that Hannah donated this week because my brethren, my ancestral brethren, were really getting beaten out by the Norwegians.
Nothing
in terms
like
of donations.
A little territorial warfare here, Maddie.
Right.
I love it.
It never ends. It never ends. And Klaus in L.A., a Gold Club donor. Thank you so much. And do remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered into the Film Spotting Hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name. You get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab. It's right there at the top of the page.
We really do appreciate all of the support. And again, Klaus in L.A., or maybe I'm saying that wrong, C-L-A-A-S, I'm not entirely sure, but an extremely generous donation there. We really do appreciate it. Our next listener's choice review is going to be The Haunting, the Robert Wise film from 1963. We hope to have that After Hours episode to you next week. If not, it will certainly be the week after that. Nothing is holding me together. No one is holding me together. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. It's top five time here on the show, and last week we did have our little tribute to Sidney Pollack, who passed away, as we mentioned, on May 26 from cancer in our Massacre Theater scene, doing a scene from Tootsie, but we thought he deserved something a little bit bigger than that.
Yeah, I really feel a lot of kinship for the man, actually. He's a Meisner actor. He was a Meisner acting teacher. And I love sort of the quotes that we read about him. Not a visual innovator.
No.
Never thought of himself as a visual innovator. His craft was working with actors and getting the actors to tell the best story possible.
Yeah, absolutely. That really was his strength. And this is a guy who was credited with 20 films as a director. He produced or executive produced over 40, and as an actor had 30 different TV and film roles. But for this top five, we're sticking to the movies he either directed or had a prominent acting role in. I just want to throw out for me, Maddie, three movies that aren't going to make the list, and I am somewhat ashamed that they're not going to be on here potentially. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? With Jane Fonda. Haven't seen it. I also haven't seen Robert Redford in the film Jeremiah Johnson that Sidney Pollack made in the early 70s. And yes, I have not seen Out of Africa. Meryl Streep, Robert Redford, a big Oscar winner. I've never been that curious about it. I'm going to have to check it out.
Yeah, I have to make the same mea culpa on Jeremiah Johnson, and they don't shoot horses, do they? Out of Africa, I have seen, I saw it as a kid.
Hmm.
So I'm actually eager to revisit it because I think my 10-year-old review was something along the lines of, this is boring, I need
mm-hmm.
candy.
Yeah.
So I actually, it's queued up. I need
Which
to
is actually
it.
Very similar to how you review movies now.
Thank you. All right, well, my number five is good old Mitch McDear, Tommy Cruise in The Firm. A lawyer backed into a corner. What's he going to do, file a writ? No, he's going to kick some Wilford Brimley ass. I unabashedly like this film. It's exciting, it's taut, and it matches the beach reading quality of what a great John Grisham novel is. I think it's a really nice film.
Okay, well, The Firm there for your number five. I'm going to go back to the 70s for my number five pick, and for this entire top five list, I'm going to try to let Sidney and his actors, fittingly, do most of the work here. Let's hear a scene.
You don't have the right style.
I'll change.
No, don't change. You're your own girl, you have your own style.
But then I won't have you. Why can't I have you? Why?
Because you push too hard.
That is a clip from The Way We Were. Safe to say, Sidney Pollack's first big hit as a director, won 2 Oscars for the music and was nominated for 4 others. You have 2 completely different people. You heard him in that scene, Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford. Completely different backgrounds. The all-American WASP boy and this activist Jewish girl, they fall in love. And out of love, as they move to Hollywood, Redford's character gets involved as a screenwriter with that whole HUAC storm swirling. Streisand, you watch this film, Maddie, you really understand, I think, why people adore her so much. She's really good, and I'm not sure that there's a word that actually captures the kind of pluckiness and spirit she has here in this movie. There's a scene early on where she sees Redford sitting at the bar in his naval uniform. You can see her almost literally melt. It's great stuff. The Way We Were is not a perfect movie by any means, but a good one.
Great pick. All right, well, my number four is Michael Clayton, and I'm using this performance here as a stand-in for all those Sidney Pollack roles mm-hmm. we've become accustomed to over the years. Eyed Wide Shut, Changing Lanes, A Civil Action, Will's dad on the television show Will and Grace, all powerful men, cutthroat to a point, but imbued with this Sidney Pollack sense of humanity. He recognized that. I think that was his genius. He recognized what he could bring to a role, and he didn't overstretch himself.
Mm-hmm. No, I really like him there in Michael Clayton, and you're right, that role is actually a surprise in many ways. It's kind of an antidote to those roles that actually we're going to hear in a second with our poll question that he really is more accustomed to playing. A good pick there. My number four, I'm going with our Massacre Theater scene from last week, Tootsie. I hope maybe you have something more to say about it. I don't know if it made your list or not. I do really like the movie. I think it actually got 10 Oscar nominations.
Wow.
Best Picture and Director. Jessica Lange won for Best Supporting Actress, but I just think that Dustin Hoffman is great fun to watch in it, and the supporting cast is so wonderful. Wonderful with Terry Garr. The scenes with Bill Murray as his friend, I think, are great to watch. So I just think it's a cute movie. Nothing more insightful to say about it, I'm afraid. It's my number four pick.
Well, this is actually my Tootsie memorial list.
Is it?
I actually really, really love that film. All right, my number three is Absence of Malice. Pauli Newman, Sally Field. Great film about journalistic ethics. You know, Sally Field, she's this reporter. She creates this story indicating Paul Newman, who's the son of this mafia chieftain, is under investigation for murder. Newman is great. Sally Field is great. Bobby Balaban is great.
Mm-hmm.
Melinda Dillon is fantastic.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would recognize Melinda Dillon from Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
That's right.
And as Ralphie's mom in A Christmas Story.
That's it. You're absolutely right. Well done there. I do like Absence of Malice as well. Well, my number three, let's go ahead and hear a quick scene.
Now look, I know what the desk clerk told you. But what he didn't tell you is all they did was put Nick on a plane to Seattle. By now he's probably back with his family, you know, banging Mrs. Nick.
The clerk said he had a bruise in his face.
Okay. He had a bruise on his face. That's a hell of a lot less than he deserves.
That's a clip from a Massacre Theater scene we actually did a few months ago on the show. Tom Cruise again in the scene with Sidney Pollack from Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. And I know that a lot of people hate this Kubrick movie, but I dig it. And I think that the way Pollack is able to be so cool while saying such sinister things is what makes it so much fun to watch. You can actually almost believe him when he says Nick Nightingale is probably back at home in Seattle with his wife and kids, even though you know in your heart there's no way that's true. That's the genius of Pollock.
Where do you think Nick Nightingale is?
I think he's in a gutter somewhere.
No.
I really do.
Really?
Yeah, I do. And I do think that it's sort of interesting that Pollock was really good, as we just touched on, at playing these characters with such loose ethics and morals, when by all accounts, as a man, he was the exact opposite. On screen, though, he's able to really navigate some pretty dark stuff.
Well, my God, I feel disillusioned. I seriously thought Nicky Nightingale was back in Seattle.
Then you don't know Sidney Pollack the way I do.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I'm going to go with what I think is his best performance. And my number two is Husbands and Wives. The insecurity he manages to convey when he finds out that his wife, who he's separated from, might be sleeping with Liam Neeson in his bed,
right,
as he calls it. All the while, of course, he's sleeping with an aerobics instructor himself. Absolutely captures the tortured and wayward neuroses and envy that we have as males.
Absolutely right. And it's actually my number two choice, the Woody Allen film from 1992. Almost made my number one, but I decided to save that for a Sidney Pollack-directed film. But this film, Husbands and Wives, it's Allen's homage to Bergman. No big surprise there. Straight out of Scenes from a Marriage, which is also a great film. But you have Pollock as Jack, and he's married to Judy Davis's Sally, who's apparently too frigid for him, and they decide to split up. And that sparks Woody and Mia's characters to split up as well. And I do love the fact, you're absolutely right, that Pollock starts seeing this hot, young, blonde aerobics instructor who's into astrology. And he, of course, eventually gets tired of that stuff.
Of course.
And it has one of my all-time favorite cinema in-jokes in it ever. They're leaving a movie theater, in a huff. She's obviously mad. They've left while the movie's going on. You see on the marquee, Akira Kurosawa's Ron is playing. That's the movie they've left. And you hear his girlfriend say, "For your information, Shakespeare didn't speak Japanese." Clearly
Brilliant.
Trying to explain to
Brilliant.
Her, yes, that it's King Lear. She doesn't get that. I love that line. It's my number two choice.
All right, well, my number one, I'm curious to see if it is your number one. It is 3 Days of the Condor. Robert Redford, and I love Robert Redford. I love the man. Not an overly talented actor.
Really?
No, he's a movie star. He's a movie star, and
I agree with that.
He reacts to situations in such a way the audience can relate to him. I mean, there's just that great sympathy and empathy that you have for him. Collaborated with Pollock on several films. I think this is his best. I just love the paranoid feel of this film. If you haven't seen it, 3 Days of the Condor, you need to.
Yeah, it's a great pick. And just quickly, I'll mention, they actually made 4 films together just in the 70s. Jeremiah Johnson, The Way We Were, 3 Days of the Condor in 75, and then The Electric Horseman, and of course worked again on
Havana.
Out of Africa and Havana, you're right. So there was a clear connection between those two guys. And actually, The Way We Were, he was being told by the studio to go with Ryan O'Neill because they could not pin Redford down. And Pollock just knew that it was only going to work with Redford. And he just kept insisting. And finally, he gave in. And that was a big movie for both of them. My number one film, Maddie, let's hear a clip.
Another movie I liked with Faye Dunaway was 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, with Robert Redford when he was young.
Yeah.
You know, I never thought it made sense, though. You know, the way they got together so quick. I mean, romantically.
Well, you did take my number one choice, Maddie, so we had some overlap there. It is 3 Days of the Condor, though I played a scene there from Steven Soderbergh's Out of Sight. You have that great scene between Karen and Jack Foley, Jennifer Lopez, and George Clooney, where they bring up 3 Days of the Condor. And it's kind of like North by Northwest in a way, where you've got the CIA guy who's really just a researcher, and he's very bookish, and then he gets in way over his head in this world of espionage. But I just think you're right. It's a classic spy movie from the 70s, captures that paranoia and disillusionment of the time. I love Redford and Faye Dunaway together, and I love how Soderbergh does appropriate it there for Out of Sight beautifully. So it's my number one as well.
Is this the first time ever that you and I had the same number one and number two movie choices?
That is a good film spotting trivia question. Maybe the first time we've ever had the top choices. For me, I did have a couple of quick honorable mentions. The Player, he plays the lawyer, Dick Mellon. I love the film. Altman's great film, but he just has a very small role in it. Changing Lanes, actually, a movie I think is kind of underrated. I think Pollock has a nice role in that. And then, of course, in Michael Clayton, where I don't love the film, but I do love the spin on his character, where we keep waiting for him to be this really unethical lawyer and do the wrong thing. And he's actually a good guy. He really wants to do the right thing,
in
but
that role,
he's corrupted.
There's never anything opaque about his performances. In that role, he injects it with that perceived cynicism that we keep waiting for.
That's
a really nice spin.
Yeah, it really is. And that actually brings us to our poll question for this week. You can go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. Tying in with our top five, we want to know which Sidney Pollack role is your favorite. Maddie, what are the choices?
Is it ethically challenged agent, Tootsie? Ethically challenged doctor, Eyes Wide Shut? Ethically challenged husband, Husband and Wives? Or ethically challenged lawyer, Michael Clayton, Changing Lanes, and The Player?
And we may even be leaving something out. So make your voice heard. We want to know which role is your favorite. Vote at filmspotting.net.
Those are our top five Sidney Pollack movies. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, Kung Fu Panda, we both say.
Check
go see
it out.
It. Yeah. And You Don't Mess with the Zohan, the new Adam Sandler movie, which we did not see, so we can't recommend it or dissuade you from it. On next week's show, we're going to review two big summer movies, The Incredible Hulk with Edward Norton, and the latest from M. Night Shyamalan, The Happening.
And Mark Wahlberg.
That's right. Mark Wahlberg is in the film. The Hulk is guaranteed. We're absolutely reviewing that movie next week. The Happening, we just want to throw out there, not 100%. There's only one screening of it, and it doesn't really necessarily work great with our schedule, so we may end up talking about it on the following week's show. And we'll also share, well, we don't know what top five we're really going to share. I came up with an idea, maybe top five movies about anger or movies that make you angry, tying in with The Hulk. But we need your help here, listeners. Send us your thoughts on what our top five should be. Feedback@filmspotting.net.
Thanks, as always, to our wonderful listener volunteers, Candace, Frank, and Angela. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Austin Donahue for this week's music. Learn more at austindonahue.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net. Everyone's going to know it. Everyone's
so.
Going to know it.
I don't think so.
Oh, you're wrong.
So.
Do you know how beloved that film is? It's truly beloved.
Dude, our listeners are 15. They don't even know what film it is.
Right.
No idea.
Well, not Chris and his son. His son's not even 15.
A little bit. A little bit.
A little bit?
A little bit.
You doing your De Niro here? Okay.
A little bit. A little bit. You insult him a little bit.
That's the worst De Niro I've ever heard.
I can do a good one. I have to listen to it, though. I've done a lot.
Okay. Let's try to actually discuss The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Oh. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's go.